Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Different skulls, purple skulls, different skulls, different skulls. Let's make this a blue evil.
Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Pete.
I'm Ben. And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where we talk about an episode of The Muppet Show 45 years after its original New York City air date. This is the Roy Clark episode, which aired on September 25th, 1978, the third production episode it had filmed between the end of February and the beginning of March in 1978. Pete, I'm going to be starting these episodes this season with a description from TV Guide whenever one is available.
Yes.
I'm planning on offering you a bonus half point.
Ooh.
For every one that you guess whether or not I have the TV Guide for a given episode. Had one for the last episode. Do you want to know what your odds are?
Well, Ben.
Yeah.
Never tell me the odds.
Never.
But Ben.
Yeah.
Please tell me the odds.
I was able to find 16 out of the 24.
Wow.
So, to start off, is there a description for the Roy Clark episode?
Roy Clark. Yes, you have one.
Incorrect.
Ah, I have a 75% chance, and I'm starting off strong.
I don't have a description for this, except for the fact that Roy Clark is a person who I did not recognize and did not know about prior to this.
Yes.
In researching some of the songs that he covered, I saw one or two things about when he sang those songs in terms of the years originally. So I have a vague sense as to the length of his recording career, but that's about it. And I will say that he wears a series of terrible outfits in this episode. One of them is a...
I thought one of them was very cool, and I hope you're not going to talk about that one.
A glossy vinyl orange button-down shirt with huge disco collars and a tan brown jacket with a banjo embedded on the back that goes up to his collarbone and big sparkles down the arms.
Ben?
Yeah.
We have such different fashion senses. While I would never wear that, I thought that looked so cool.
Well, let me say this. He wore that exact same outfit in 1971 during his live performance of Rocky Top in front of a huge concert audience. So 7 years earlier, he was able to fit into that exact outfit. So I'm
impressive.
I am giving him some decent props in terms of being able to maintain his welterweight status in a way that I certainly haven't over the course of 7 years.
Well, Ben, since you admitted you don't know anything about Roy Clark, why don't we jump in right into the quiz?
Sounds good.
Question one. Which country music star once fired Roy Clark as the lead guitarist in his band for being habitually tardy? A. Burl Ives. B. Jimmy Dean. Or C. Johnny Cash?
Jimmy Dean.
Correct. The Sausage Man himself fired Roy Clark in 1957 after he joined the band in 1954.
Is that the same Jimmy Dean who did a talk show that Rolf sometimes appeared on?
I do not know, but I'm going to assume yes, because I was surprised to learn that the country music artist was the same man as the Sausage Man. Mm. So I'm going to assume he was just everywhere, well, which is that... why he, like Paul Newman, why he turned into the Sausage Man, because he was just that ubiquitous. Question number two. Roy Clark has won many awards over his career, and as I love talking about what awards my people have won, but what was his first win at the 1970 Country Music Awards? A. Best Comedian. B. Best Lead Guitarist of the Year. Or C. Best Television Personality.
B.
Incorrect, it was Best Comedian.
That's wild.
Yep. Didn't know that the Country Music Awards gave Best Comedian.
Also, as we'll get into it in this, when we talk about his individual sketches in this episode, his comedian nature is specious at best.
Mm-hmm. He was nominated in all three of those categories in 1970. He lost lead guitarist to Al Bruno, and he lost television personality to Johnny Cash. He won Entertainer of the Year in 1972 and 73 from the Academy of Country Music Awards, and in 73 from the Country Music Awards. In 75 and 76, he won Best Instrumental Group of the Year with Buck Trent. In 77, 78, and 80, he won Instrumentalist of the Year.
Wow.
And in 82, he won his first and only Grammy for Best Country Instrumental Performance.
So, huge award winner within the country music scene, but not necessarily a crossover into the popular audience.
Correct.
Got it.
Question number 3. Roy Clark wasn't just a musician, he was also an actor. On which of the following shows was he on nearly 300 episodes of?
Ah.
A. Bonanza. B. Dallas. C. Hee-Haw.
C.
Correct. I used a non-specific number there because neither Wikipedia or IMDb can agree on how many episodes he was on. Wikipedia says it was 294. IMDb says 352. Hee-Haw was on for 655 episodes.
I would not have guessed that if you hadn't done the comedian thing.
Yeah,
earlier.
Yeah, I know. But I was damned either way. If I started with Hee-Haw, then you would have gotten comedian. So, yeah, the show was on from 1969 to 1993 for its original run, and then it was picked up again for one more year in 96 to 97.
93?
Yeah.
Holy cow.
I mean, I remember watching that show in both reruns and, I guess, live. Roy was the co-host and had regular segments where he would play a song or he would play the banjo while trading bad jokes with Buck Owens. So, as you just said, that was totally
that's his shtick.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And that shtick was enough to get him Comedian of the Year in 1970. Also, Hee-Haw was the brainchild of Jim Henson's talent manager, Bernie Brillstein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a big section in Brillstein's memoir about him putting the idea together and selling it and how cheap it was and how financially successful it was.
And it may be why Roy is on the show. Question 4. At whose funeral, by personal request, did Roy Clark perform Yesterday When I Was Young in 1995? A. Burl Ives. B. Dean Martin. Or C. Mickey Mantle.
Do I have any idea which of those people died in 1995? No,
ben,
I do not.
They all died in 1995.
But let me put that another way. Was I paying attention to any of those people when I was reading the Boston Globe obits in 1995? Burl Ives.
Mickey Mantle. After growing up in Virginia, moving to New York as a child, and then to Washington, D.C. in his young adult life, Roy Clark eventually moved to Oklahoma, where Mickey Mantle was also from. I could otherwise not really find any connection between the two of them. So it may have just been they both lived in Oklahoma, and Mickey Mantle really liked that song. Question 5. While we're talking about Yesterday When I Was Young, while Roy Clark had the highest charting version of it, which Muppet Show guest star originally wrote it? A. Charles Aznavour. B. Judy Collins. Or C. Paul Williams.
C.
Incorrect. It was the ever-present Charles Aznavour.
Ah.
Charles Aznavour wrote it in French originally, known as, I'm reading here, Albalpon.
Why don't you try that one more time?
Charles Aznavour wrote it in French originally known as Air Encore?
Hier? H-I-E-R?
H-E-I-R?
I think you transposed those vowels accidentally.
I don't think I did.
Hier means yesterday.
Okay, fair. I think it's pronounced Albalpon. Roy Clark recorded it in 1969, and it was his highest charting song, reaching number 9 on the Hot Country Billboard charts and 19 on the pop charts. So, you got 3 correct. Good job.
Thanks.
Roy Clark was around for a while. He started his career in the early 50s, as I said.
Mm-hmm.
He was performing in the late 40s, I think. He started very young. There was something in there in his biography about when he moved to D.C. as a young adult, he would go to clubs. And there's a sentence in his Wikipedia where he says, I never copied anyone, but I was certainly influenced by them, especially by George Barnes. I just loved his swing style and tone. And then 2 sentences later, he also says, one of the things that influenced me growing up around Washington, D.C. in the 50s was that it had an awful lot of good musicians, and I used to go in and just steal them blind.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, you give enough interviews over a long career, you're going to say multiple different things about yourself.
Yeah, but I love how they're right next to each other. When I was skimming through, I was like, what? And one last interesting fact, since we love talking about inflation.
Yes.
In 1971, Roy Clark was the highest paid country music star in the United States, earning $7 million, which is $52,700,000 in 2022 dollars.
Holy cow.
So he, despite only getting a song barely cracking the top 20 of the Billboard chart, highest paid country music star.
He's got a bizarre persona on the show. In that he both is able to laugh at himself and yet is kind of strangely immobile and a little bit wooden. He has a good sense of showmanship and is able to do that amazing piece where he's faking playing two instruments and probably actually playing two instruments, but giving a good job at looking like he's doing all of them. And then yet when he performs, he almost does nothing. Like, there's no flourishes, no fluidity. He stands stock still and has almost no sense of showmanship. So he's a very good performer and a very bad performer simultaneously.
He was, okay, he may not have actually been playing those instruments in Rocky Top, but he does know how to, that was.
But he could play all four of those instruments, are you sure?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Yeah, he won awards for guitar, banjo, and fiddle. And what was the fourth
Mandolin.
One?
Mandolin.
Yeah, I assume he could play that too. despite his joke during the talk spot about saying, oh, I can play seven or eight and only one out of five of them well. That was self-effacing. Mm.
But his persona is very weird. And he reminded me, actually, a little bit of prior Muppet guest Bob Hope, who also had that thing of an enormous amount of charm and almost zero stage presence, where he just sort of coasted on the fact that he was Bob Hope. And I wonder if there's some of that going on here with Roy Clark, that he'd been so successful and was so well paid that he was didn't feel the need to do more than that, except to be charming, but to do no additional showmanship.
Yeah, because I feel like he was at times, as you were saying, very charismatic. And then he's very charismatic with himself. He is not very charismatic with Muppets.
Well, I'm also basing some of this on having watched that performance of Rocky Top from 71. It's a fascinating video that we'll link to in the show notes of him on this giant stage with an enormous amphitheater audience in front of him. And he's holding a steel guitar that he's not playing for the first couple verses. And then he joins in the orchestra, but they're all in the dark in the orchestra pit, and it's just him on stage. And so the show is him, but there's all this music that's backing him up that is invisible to the audience. He's the only person that is there for show, but he's actually making the least amount of music, despite the fact that he's the headliner of the whole setup.
That sounds like my dream as a performer. To be performing, but no one can see me? Whew. I love that idea.
You would like to do backup for Roy Clark.
Yeah. If only I had any musical talent.
Well, we've got a couple of songs of his to talk about. We've got his, as you mentioned, his relationship with the Muppets.
Sure do. Well, let's start the episode not hot, but cold, with the cold open, where Scooter jumps in saying 15 seconds to curtain.
And we have a completely differently dressed dressing room. We've never seen the dressing room from this particular angle before. Roy's getting on his cowboy suit and is asking, ostensibly, Scooter what's going on. And the instead of the normal look, which is someone at a makeup table, somebody sitting down in a dressing gown, he is standing up in front of almost an alcove, what would probably be an open closet hanging clothes area, except it's not that. There aren't lots of costumes behind him.
See, I think we have seen this before, but when the times we've had this angle before, there's been a dressing curtain behind it where the typically female guest star would be using that as a privacy screen.
But there were also windows, which you tend not to have in a dressing room.
They're frosted glass.
So I
think British people are too polite to look in anyways.
And it's in the Muppet Studio, which is such a big space.
Yep.
People would be miles away from those windows.
Yeah, it's on the second floor, so that's at least a mile or two high.
So you already mentioned last episode that there are no more photographs of other Muppets and Muppet performers in the background.
That was just how this season started. I don't know how it's going to go.
And that was from the middle of the production. This is now early in the production. And we have a new shot. So we're just paying attention to changes and alterations in the vibe of the show now that it's the third season.
Yes.
We'll keep an eye on it as we go. Roy is talking, as I mentioned, ostensibly to Scooter. And he points out, while he's putting on his cowboy suit, he doesn't have chaps.
Yes, he wants to know where his pair of chaps are.
At which point, a British-looking Muppet with a cane and a waistcoat and a pig with a bowler hat and an additional walking stick walk in front of him.
Yeah, just two British chaps doing British chap things, and then they leave. Cut to curtain, 25 seconds.
Wow.
Yep, 10 seconds off. Way to go, Scooter.
Well, I would say maybe blame it on the chaps. After all, you've got the first chap, the whatnot chat, who goes, hello, 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 and then he repeats it exactly the same.
True. Okay, Scooter didn't know that a pair of chaps were going to interrupt him, throwing off the rest of the show.
By a whole 10 seconds.
They had to cut 10 seconds from somewhere then. There is a note in the fandom page that one of the chaps was built using part of the Statler puppet.
Huh.
And I think it's the pig.
Interesting. Of perhaps an interesting side note, the two chaps are played by Nelson and Hunt, which means that the shot of Scooter coming in the door had to have been filmed completely separately.
Yep.
I definitely, because of our discussion about Jerry Nelson feeling slightly left out of the spotlight, paid a significant amount of attention as to who is in what scene in this episode.
Mm.
So I may be boring you over the course of our conversation today as to who is in each scene. We then go to the opening, as you say, where instead of a Statler and Waldorf bit, we have a Scooter bit.
Yeah.
They cut to backstage where Scooter cries out, hey, somebody kill that light. There's a splash of machine gun sound effects, and a light drops from the ceiling behind him.
Obviously at a lower level than we've seen lights drop before, because it was pretty quick the distance that light fell. Then we go to Gonzo, and he blows the trumpet, and a party favor blows out of it, and he does it three times, and then excitedly exclaims, three times!
Another thing that we talked about last episode was whether or not you would keep track of people talking directly to the audience.
Yep, forgot about that until after I watched the episode the second time.
I'll just point out then that Roy says it's a far cry from Oklahoma directly to the audience. Would you say that Gonzo saying three times is to the audience?
Oh, I thought we were doing camera takes.
Yeah, camera takes. So
okay. But
let's talk, say, the Muppet Newsman. When the Muppet
Doesn't
Newsman
count.
Is talking to camera, is he talking to the audience at home, or is he talking to the camera because he's a television person?
Yes, I think it's office style, breaking the fourth wall, not a newsman talks to camera. That wouldn't count.
So in Gonzo saying three times, is he saying that to the Muppet audience, or is he saying that to the camera?
Depends on where his eyes are, if they're looking down the barrel or not.
I took it as him talking to the audience.
Okay.
So, I've got your numbers on takes for today.
Yes. Thank you.
Then we go to curtain. Kermit says that the whole show is going country tonight because our guest is one of the world's greatest country stars.
I think my awards talk proves that.
Fozzie interrupts. He's wearing a coonskin cap and carrying a long, vertically wrapped package of something.
Yeah, it's either a gun or a fishing rod.
Makes sense. and says that he's told everybody...
To the country, let's go, everybody, from the Midwest, to the country.
Wait a minute. When I said that the show was going country, just because Mr. Roy Clark is our guest.
Oh, yeah, one of my favorite performers.
Yeah, well, I didn't mean it would actually be Al Fresco.
Oh, he's good, too.
Kermit tells him that that's incorrect, and Scooter enters to say that, and to tell Kermit that the stagehands have all left.
Kermit freaks out, as is his wont.
Yep. And Fozzie and Kermit get in a great Frank and Jim argument. Kermit then informs Fozzie that since it was his mistake, he needs to be the stagehand for this episode.
Fozzie goes from being aghast to resigned, and then runs to pull the curtain in order to introduce the multitudinously talented Mr. Roy Clark.
So then we start hearing Rocky Top.
Begins with Slim Charles in screen, and then it turns into a split screen with other members of the Lubbock Lou Jug Band. The screen split into quarters, and then one quarter at a time, the Muppet is replaced with a version of Roy Clark. So we have a banjo, a left-handed bass, a rhythmic acoustic guitar, and a tambourine replaced by a banjo, a mandolin, a steel guitar, and a fiddle. And Roy is doing a passable job of pretending to play all of them.
See,
to himself in the other squares.
I honestly think he's playing them all because he's giving good musician face during all of these. Of while he's playing a solo, he's doing the laughable thing that people make fun of, like Eric Clapton doing, of like the wahs that he's mouthing lad along. And one of the reasons why I truly think he's playing... Mm. Because that's one of those instinctual things that musicians just do, and whether they're aware of it or not, I think if they're doing it, they're subconsciously just in the moment. I don't think they can fake it. Could be wrong. I don't know. I don't have any musical ability.
I don't know this piece well enough, and I don't know the members of Sam Pottle's Muppet Orchestra well enough to say what would be the easiest way to do this. Would it be to have the session musicians, where we normally have either a rock band or a small band, would they be good enough to do four string instruments? Or would it be easier to have Roy loop himself four times? My guess is it would be simpler to have four session musicians playing. Now, maybe Roy brought his own group with him, or had people that he knew how to play with. Or maybe the Sam Pottle Orchestra is just that good and they had these guys on tap. Any guess on that would be wild speculation on our part.
Well, for my wild speculation, I would refer back to his multi-award winning Instrumentalist of the Year awards to say, I'm sure he could, and because you said earlier you found video of him playing this in 71.
Yep,
he just knew it.
He played the steel electric guitar, and he's clearly a very good banjo player. Mm-hmm. It's the other two instruments that I doubt. Mm. It's the mandolin and the fiddle. Especially because when he comes out with the fiddle at the very end, he's not making notes on it. He's just sawing away and not producing real good sound.
But I think there's a different reason for that.
Okay.
Which is, it's not a real fiddle.
So because it's a badly strung fake fiddle, he couldn't make sound on it. But maybe in the studio beforehand, he was able to play it.
Correct.
Possible. I took a look at the history of Rocky Top the song. It was written in 67, originally played by the Osborne Brothers after being written by Felice and Boudelot Bryant. They were writing a bunch of songs for some country musicians, and it was very slow-paced, and according to an interview, they wrote this just as a change to do something different, have a nice upbeat song, and they wrote most of it in about 10 minutes.
Hey, those classic 10-minute written songs.
Now, why do you think that this took about 10 minutes to write?
I don't know, because it's probably just the same part four times in different with different instruments.
Well, the way it's performed here, which is from 251 to 413, there are no lyrics.
Well, yes, that too.
And then he sings Rocky Top about five times between 440 and 444. Do I have that right? No, between 415 and 440. That's almost no lyrics at all. However, this is a fully fledged song. This song does exist in other formats. In fact, it is used as the marching theme for the University of Tennessee Volunteers and Lady Volunteers.
One of the best school mascots of all time.
Well, I took a little look at that because I was weirded out by Volunteers as a mascot.
Truly wild.
And apparently, according to an article on culturetrip.com, which was written in 2018, they're called that because they sent 1,500 soldiers to the War of 1812, and they also sent 30,000 soldiers down to Texas in 1846 in order to provide support in the Mexican-American War, specifically because of Davy Crockett, who they claimed was a son of Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, in that 2018 article, when they talk about the War of 1812, and they talk about a war that happened in 1846, they don't mention how many volunteers were in a little war in between those dates. So, how many volunteers were there?
Yeah, I mean, you can assume that it was every brother and brother.
So, yeah. It's very much a song that is part of the warp and weft of that culture. But if you listen to the lyrics, it's about people live up on the mountains, they are bootleggers, and they'll kill outsiders.
Yeah. And I think it deserves to be in the pantheon of songs that have taken 10 minutes to write, like Jolene and I Will Always Love You, which famously and apocryphally were written on the same day by Dolly Parton.
Well, I think that the instrumentalist, the instrumentalization and performance of this is a lot of fun.
Yes.
And the split screen helps make it entertaining. It creates a vibe that has been duplicated on YouTube for 2 decades
mm-hmm.
now. That split screen, multiple people doing things.
Or same person doing multiple. Yeah.
Exactly. Thank you. Is so much fun, and they do it really well here.
The Muppets, however, barely applicable.
As far as I can tell, there are no Muppet vocals, despite four Muppets appearing in this.
Just Roy Clark. We then get an audience shot, mm-hmm. one of the new audience shots.
And this audience shot, you can really see the bands of melded together footage.
Mm.
It's much harder to see in the why don't we get things started shot, but if you look at this particular one, you can see the blurry redness of the composited together.
We then get Statler and Waldorf, where Waldorf doesn't know how Roy made all those versions of himself.
Mm-hmm.
And Statler shows him by having 2 other versions of his head appear floating around him.
In a great real-time in-camera special effect that's very effective.
Yep.
We then go backstage, and we have Roy walking across the backstage area with his fiddle, immediately followed by Roy with his mandolin, and immediately followed by Roy with his guitar. And up in the dressing room balcony, we have Floyd clocking all this and matching his walking very badly.
And speaking of lines, one of the Roys that walks past makes one of the signs under a table waver, and when the next Roy comes in, it stops very quickly.
Floyd says that Roy Clark sure is a numerous person, which is a great piece of language for those of you who are familiar with the translation in the King James Bible of the man possessed by demons. For he is legion, for we are many. I like the idea that that's pretty parallel to he is a numerous person. And then the fourth Roy with the banjo comes across and says directly to camera, you can say that again.
And I'm surprised he doesn't, because that's a Muppet Show joke we've seen time and time again.
It would have been funnier if the third Roy had said that, and then the fourth Roy had also said you could say that again.
Yeah. 45 years. Punch anything up. At that point, Kermit once again accosts Fozzie about there being no stagehands and tells him that if anything goes wrong during tonight's show, Fozzie will be fired.
Fozzie is verklempt about this, saying his nerves are shot. He goes into a mini monologue talking about how he needs to calm down. It's going to be fine. The stage is set. The star is here. The audience is happy, which he also says down the barrel.
Yep.
And Scooter is trying to get his attention during all this and points out that the theater is on fire. And then, much like earlier when he went from fear to resignation in I'm going to shift the scenery, he then repeats himself here, from the theater is on fire to the theater is on fire!
We then cut to the Swedish Chef, which, you know, the theater's on fire. Let's go to the stage. And the Swedish Chef is rolling out some dough this week. The dough keeps growing lumps, and the chef keeps trying to shove them down. After flouring the dough, he slaps the dough, 15 times. I watched this so many times, and eventually, because it's immediately after, he basically LeBrons the flower up in the air, so you can't really see through it. I had to try counting the number of slaps that I could hear, and I eventually just kind of went, yeah, it was 15. It sounds like 15.
Back when we had the chocolate mousse episode, I talked about the fact that you could see mousse and chocolate on his lips from previous takes. And you can see flour from previous takes all over the front of the Swedish Chef here.
Mm-hmm. The dough keeps rising, even after he beats it down initially.
He gets out a rolling pin and tries to squash it.
Eventually the dough grabs the rolling pin and then hits the chef with it for our 16th hit already this episode.
Of potential interest is that the dough is voiced by Frank.
Oh.
Who typically does the hands of the Swedish Chef. So did he do the voice of the dough while somebody else was doing the puppeteering? Or was somebody else doing the hands of the chef at this point? It's difficult to guess.
Hmm. We then go backstage for our second time, where after being hit in the head, Chef walks backstage all woozy-like, while Fozzie is still shouting fire in a theater. Kermit enters to ask what's going on. Fozzie says everything's fine. Kermit notices that the smoke is happening, and Fozzie comes up with a bad excuse for what it is. He says that there's jets flying overhead.
He says, this is just exhaust. Kermit says, just exhaust? Right down the barrel of the camera.
Mm-hmm.
Fozzie goes, yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say, as if somehow this helps his lie. And then does an amazingly bad impression where he goes, oh, look, here comes another one, grabs Kermit to pull him down in case he might get hit by this imaginary airplane.
Duck! You okay? You okay?
What was that?
Oh, boy, that was a close one. Those planes get lower every day.
Fozzie, I didn't see any plane.
Yeah, they get faster, too.
Meanwhile, on the dressing room balcony behind them, Scooter is watching all this and ducks as if he's afraid he's also going to get hit by the plane.
Even though he's the one who knows the real reason that it's all smoky. Great bit of business.
Scooter has no voice during this. Scooter says nothing. This is entirely a Jim and Frank bit. There are other puppets in the scene, but none of them speaks, including the Swedish Chef, who would have been voiced by Jim.
And hands by Frank.
Uh-huh. So it's particularly odd, this and the next backstage segment, in terms of who is contributing to this. It gives me the feeling that maybe these were filmed quickly ad hoc. I talked last episode about the fact that a lot of these episodes were squished together in terms of production time. The fandom page gives no indication that there was an overlap between this and the next episode, but there is a Muppet that appears in Pigs in Space who makes his official premiere next episode.
Oh.
And so it feels like there's some cram being done in here, that there are puppets that are being performed in the background but never talking, as if they just sort of had somebody guest puppeteer them, but without the sense of who they really were. And Scooter is doing that in this scene.
Mm-hmm. After the airplane goes overhead, Fozzie ushers Kermit out and calls the operator on the phone to ask for the fire department. And water dribbles out of the earpiece, just like the gag from season one, but worse.
Yeah, it's a very drippy water.
It should be off a fire hose level.
Yeah. We cut two pigs in space. This is our first Pigs in Space of the new season, and we no longer have the floating heads intro with the vocabulary. Mm-hmm. In fact, we don't even have the pew-pew of the planets going past. We just cut to the swine trek, as it's described by the voiceover narrator, floating helplessly in space. It's drifting aimlessly, he says, due to a loss of power in the control panels.
Which, as we go inside, they are trying to fix. Dr. Strangepork has taken parts from the toaster to fix it.
Which is the hand wave explanation for when Link starts pulling on the levers on the now fixed control panel. The cast are then sucked down into the belly of the swine trek as if they're going down into a toaster slot. Yeah. Because if you take a fuse from one thing, it replaces the mechanical action of another.
Yeah. Now, Ben, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
Are they falling when they go down?
Because this is the thing you're tracking.
It is.
Well, let me say this. We have some business of Piggy being dropped down. She comes up. She drops Strange Pork. She's trying to drop Link, but failing.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually he drops himself.
Yes.
When he comes back up, he's sucking his thumb and asking for his mommy.
Yeah, it's definitely not a pleasant experience. But one thing that's not addressed in this is it also hot when you go down?
If it's a toaster, that might be the implication, but there's no darkening, there's no soot effects.
There's no smoke.
I think there
should be, because the theater is actively on fire right now.
It feels more like they're being put into space.
But a toaster just goes finite down, because we do know that there are trap doors under there, because mm-hmm. we've seen that before. So this isn't a trap door, because they go down and they come back.
So I don't think they're falling if they're able to be sprung back up. And there is a sound effect of a spring mm-hmm. when they get shot back into their seats, which implies that they're on something. As opposed to just falling. That okay. They're like on a platform or something. This, of course, all goes out the window shortly thereafter because other people start being brought up from the toaster action. The first being Gonzo.
Hey, I'm not supposed to be here, right?
Right.
Who, I think this might be Dave... No, I was going to say, this might be Dave Gold's first appearance on the Swine Track, but Gonzo has previously been a UFO
mm-hmm.
on a motorcycle in space. And then a series of other things get brought up. We have a Kuzbanian Beaker, who, while we've previously talked about Link maybe never breaking character, he recognizes Beaker, mm-hmm. which I don't think Captain Link Hogthrob would have. So that's him bringing in his I work in the Muppet Theater as an actor experience onto stage. Then a witch doctor who makes his official premiere in episode 304.
Okay.
And we have a giant pile of what looked to me like rocks, but turns out to be an alien made of chopped liver from the planet Zabar, who appeared previously in the Cloris Leachman Pigs in Space episode.
Oh. I thought one of them was Lunch Counter Monster.
Yes, we also get okay. Lunch Counter Monster, and the last person who comes up is Statler.
There's also a chicken.
Yes, thank you. So lots of up and down. Very yeah. wild, very chaotic. It's kind of a slow start, and then it just turns into let's have different Muppets appear, and it turns out to be a lot of fun.
Yep. If those were falls, there would have been 11 of them. But they aren't falls, so there aren't 11 falls in this sketch.
Hang on.
Yeah.
There were 11 people going down into the belly of the ship.
Yeah, it's like 5 or 6 from the main cast, and then...
And then the replacements of the others.
Yeah.
But none of that matters.
Nope, not this year. Unless toasters become a running theme, in which case...
I mean, I don't think toasters become a running theme until Windows 5.1.
3.1?
I'm not sure.
It was 3.1. It went 3.195.
Okay.
I'm a millennial. I know these things.
We then cut to the Statler and Waldorf box, except it's not Statler and Waldorf, because Statler is currently on the Swine Track.
Mm-hmm. It's just Waldorf, and he says, I don't believe that.
And then Gonzo springs up into the empty spot and says what he said earlier, I'm not supposed to be here. And then whoops back down.
Not fall 12. We then, with no introduction, cut to the stage with the band in the orchestra pit, and the curtain opens, and Roy walks out.
I love this introduction. I like almost anything that treats the Muppet stage like a stage,
mm-hmm.
and therefore clearly gives me an indication as to what kind of action this is. This is being performed in the Muppet Theater for the Muppet audience, and I don't have to worry about... Is this being done on stage? Is this being done on camera? Is there a camera? What's going on?
But there's no intro from Kermit from the guest star.
That's right.
And that's very rare.
It is very rare. Another thing that's rare, but increasingly common this particular season, is there's a non-traditional trumpeter in the band pit. So in season one, in the Muppet band, in the orchestra pit, Aaron Oscar played the velvet-suited female trumpeter.
Mm-hmm.
And then in various other episodes, when there has needed to be a trumpet playing with the Electric Mayhem, they've just made up trumpeters. So, for example, in the Lou Rawls episode where they have the big band, they have 2 guest trumpeters, including, I believe, Bobby Benson. And then last episode with Helen Reddy, they just made up a brand new trumpeter in the recording studio. Well, here we have one of the Sleaze brothers playing trumpet. And weirdly enough, we have a totally made-up new Muppet playing the flute in a prominent photo position when Roy comes and sits down on the stage. In our previous episode, which of course was filmed several months afterwards, Zoot plays the flute in the recording studio.
Mm-hmm.
But Zoot is playing the sax in this, so he wasn't being a multi-instrumentalist in this case.
Listen, Ben, the Muppet Show is a very independent organization. They can't afford a script supervisor to keep track of this continuity.
All I'm saying is, who's referred to as the trumpet girl in the Muppet Wikia, will show back up in the credits of every episode in season 3. However, there will be multiple trumpeters who are not her, because she never appears in, according to the fandom page, in any episode as herself in season 3.
Hmm.
She has multiple season 1 and season 2 appearances, zero season 3. You know who plays the trumpet in this episode? Roy Clark plays the trumpet, but Trumpet Girl does not.
Ben, even though she's already appeared in season 1 and season 2, she's just paying her dues, much like Louise Gold did, and she's finally going to get her day in season 4, I'm sure of it.
I mean, Aaron Oscar hasn't been with the show for a whole season. Louise Gold, finally coming in, isn't playing Trumpet Girl. And they will eventually replace her with Lips, a male trumpeter with the Electric Mayhem later.
Good for the Muppet Show to not just assume that the new woman is going to play the same Muppets as the old woman.
Bad for the Muppet Show in taking an established female performer and being like, we don't need more than one woman in the band. Let's get rid of her.
We already have Janice.
That's right.
Played by a man.
We have a token woman. Let's get rid of anybody else.
Anyway, we're talking a lot not about this sketch because it's boring.
it's beautiful, but it's emotional, which is your least favorite kind of Muppet Show sketch. It's something that's supposed to be felt.
Yesterday, when I was young, so many happy songs were waiting to be sung.
But as you've said many times, the purpose of the Muppet Show is to do things that other shows couldn't. And this sketch, now to its credit, does have a real dog on stage for 70% of the song.
Who's then replaced by a Muppet dog as a special effect.
Right. But that dog was so chill, and we've seen Muppets do things to dogs that are clearly drugged in the past. They could have just drugged that dog and had the real dog.
That dog was one of the most well-trained dogs I've ever seen,
it
which
truly
made
was.
Me incredibly afraid for it, because it knew how to lie down and be quiet.
Yeah.
So it had clearly been instructed within an inch of its life.
And I loved the real dog.
Mm.
I do also love the fake dog, but that was a real good real dog. But there was no point of Muppets in this segment, just like there were no point of Muppets in the first segment.
What do you think about his outfit in this? He's wearing a bright orange fringed leather jacket with a brown plaid shirt and blue jeans and a huge country belt buckle.
Listen, unlike my friend Zach, I am not a self-proclaimed country boy.
Mm.
I'm sure Zach would love this outfit. I thought it was fine. I didn't notice it because
it wasn't the garish.
I was bored immediately. I was looking at the dog because there was a dog on screen. I don't even know if Roy Clark was in this or not.
Well, considering you wrote two questions about this song, I think you're going to be pretty sure that Roy Clark was in
this. Yeah, I'm sure he was, but I didn't notice because it was boring. Hey, Ben.
Yeah?
Let's Play for the second week in a row. Was the next thing the UK spot or not?
I'm pretty sure I know that the next thing was the UK spot because, as I have criticized before, the weird transitions that sometimes happen after the UK spot, and I wonder how that editing would happen. Well, this has a fade to black at the end of Yesterday When I Was Young,
mm-hmm.
and then we have a song, and then we have a quick fade up and down from black with the sketch after that. So they clearly built that one so that it could come back from an ad, as opposed to previous ones where I was like, that would be an awkward transition back from an ad.
But this segment has plot points to it,
mm.
and the characters show up at the end of the episode.
Mmm. It is, however, a song that is not in keeping with the other music that's in the episode. This song is called I Don't Want to Set the World on Fire, which was first recorded in 1940 by Harlan Loomis and his Rockets, with vocals by Myra Taylor. It was performed by the Ink Spots and Guy Lombardo in 1941, and this arrangement is sort of a combination of those two arrangements. The overlapping harmonic vocals of the Ink Spots, but they did a slower, goopier version, and so it's like a Guy Lombardo tempo with an Ink Spots harmonies is how it's done here by these four firemen that come on stage.
I don't want to set the world on fire.
You don't have to. It started already.
Our listeners might know this song from either, because I'm not sure what I recognize it from.
You recognize it from either The Simpsons or from Fallout.
One of those is correct. Fallout or Bioshock.
Ah.
Also probably The Simpsons, but that was not was going to be one of the things I said.
Its Wikipedia entry is pretty clear about how the Ink Spots version of this particularly has been used to have that ironic contrast of beautiful melodies about things burning up. Mm-hmm. And it gets associated with a particular kind of comic post-apocalyptic wasteland.
Yep.
Despite the fact that that is a comic irony that these video games and adaptations are using, the Muppets didn't trust that they would have a natural comic timing to it, and so they have Fozzie doing a lot of business in this, and most of it doesn't work, including the wrap-up, where there's a chicken clucking noise. Fozzie says, "Don't worry, I'll save you from the fire that the firemen are not paying attention to," and he rushes in with a life preserver, which he then puts around the chicken to pull it out of the fire.
Hey, Ben. This also made no sense to me, but I loved it.
Of course you did.
Why would you use a water-based saving device to save something from fire? You don't. Great. Great joke. Loved it. Might have been one of my moments.
Well, I'm glad I short-circuited that, because otherwise I would lose all respect for you. Yeah. This is a lot of nonsense. But let me ask you, who's the lead Muppet performer in this?
Frank, I'd assume.
Nope. It's Peter Friedman.
Who's that?
Yeah, that's what I figured you should be on top of, but apparently aren't. Peter Friedman is on a few episodes of the beginning of season 3 before he no longer comes back, and that's who Steve Whitmire replaces.
Oh, okay.
I don't know anything, because I figured you would be on top of this, but apparently not. It'll probably be in production episode 301. He'll be in 301 or 3 and 302, and so in the episode notes for those, it will mention, by the way, this features Peter Friedman, but because we're seeing them slightly out of order, the fandom page probably didn't talk about it.
He was also in season 1.
Yeah, who'd he do in season 1?
In Lena Horne, he was the lead ragmop.
Yes, I remember that now.
In the article about him on the fandom page, he was in production episodes 11 through 15. So it must have been like a short stint where they were like, maybe someone couldn't make it or they needed extra hands. So they were just like, okay, come in for these five.
We definitely talked about him in the Ragmop episode because his voice was so distinctive and because there was that behind-the-scenes photograph of them all doing the mops and he wasn't in it.
Mm.
And so there was this oddity of his voice but not his Muppet performance. He's all throughout this episode in the big group numbers. In fact, Frank isn't. So we have a couple of backstage segments with Frank and Jim and other Muppets being performed not by their voices. And then we have a bunch of group scenes with Henson, Gold, Goals, Hunt, Nelson, and Friedman without Oz.
Mm-hmm.
So something scheduling was going on in this, and Friedman pitched in. But he's also this prominent voice in this sketch where he's just in the mix in the rest of the episode.
After the fade up, as Ben described earlier, because it's the UK spot, we are back in a season 1 episode location, the talk spot.
Yep. A thing that I assured you in season 2 would never come back.
Was destroyed because they were so sure it was never coming back.
And this is a tried and true traditional talk spot conversation.
And how many of those instruments can you actually play?
Can I actually play Kermit?
Yes.
Actually?
Yes.
Maybe 1 out of 5 would be a good average.
1 out of 5.
No, but I attempt to play about 7 or 8.
It's got bad jokes. It's got guest Muppets coming in at the very end. It's about personality and trying to establish rapport but not really working. It does all of the things that the season one Talkspot did and failed to do.
It has not only bad jokes, but jokes that I literally don't understand. Like, not just bad jokes.
Give me an example.
When the cow is introduced, Roy asks,
how many head of cattle do you have?
One. One head of cow.
And Roy laughs. Is it a head of state joke? Is it a head of lettuce joke? I don't know why that's a joke.
Head of cattle is a way of referring to, I believe, a group of cattle for sale. I'm going to get this wrong, but when you're doing auctions or livestock, you just refer to them as head of cattle. And why that is a convention, I don't know.
I just Googled it, and you are mostly correct.
Yeah.
A head of cattle is valid through paraphrastic way, don't know what that word is, to refer to one animal of indeterminate or unknown age and sex.
So regardless of what gender it is, whether it's going to be a bull or a cow, it is a head of cattle. And so the joke is because there's only one cow, Kermit's being confused by the, this isn't a livestock, this is our cow, who's voiced by Richard Hunt. That's just, so that's our head of cow as opposed to our head of cattle.
Okay. Duly noted, something that was said clearly in the 70s and by farmers, so why I would never know because I have not yet gotten desperate enough to sign up for Farmers Only as a dating app.
Also, as a person who, while this may be a country episode, you have resisted watching Westerns for most of your life, you just never would have encountered one of the many, many, many Saturday morning black and white films where it's all about people roping and throwing heads of cow.
Hey, I did watch almost 2 whole seasons of Yellowstone.
Well, yeah, because you're a dad now.
I'm not a dad now.
You watched Yellowstone, therefore you're a dad.
Right. I became a dad while I was watching Yellowstone in Ouvre-Aubal-Pont. Is that how you pronounce
That's how you pronounce Ouvre, yes.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I thought so. And then it ends with, Ben, let's play another round of the returning segment. Did this episode have a content warning on it? Because of this last comment by Kermit, where Roy eventually starts talking about how he's excited about being back on the farm because it reminds him of all the meals he could eat, and he starts listing off all the different
because
meals.
There's chickens and a cow and ducks and a couple of pigs. And he says, yeah, this is just like being back on the farm. This place is like a built-in lunch counter. And Kermit says the tasteless joke. It may look like lunch, but it's going to turn into a lynching. I'm going to say no, there wasn't a content warning.
Not a content warning. But even though I was in the room by myself watching this, I felt the air get sucked out of the room when this was said.
Yeah, this is no good, very bad, don't do it, and would not have passed any writer's room worth its salt if it was being made today.
But it's also 78, which is way past the civil rights movement. It shouldn't have flown then, either.
I think it's been clear, this is not going to make it into the episode, that the Supreme Court has sold us that the civil rights movement never really happened.
Yeah, fair.
We can undo that any time that we want.
Hey, at least they had them for a little while, unlike women, because the equal rights movement
has never been ratified.
Nope.
Take that, Louise Gold.
So glad none of that's making it into the episode. After that very bad segment, we go to yet another segment that Ben swore would never be back. We go to At the Line Dance.
Oh, nicely done.
Thank you. That's why I wanted to take head on that one.
Head of cattle.
What?
Head of cattle?
No, I heard you. I was playing dumb, like I didn't know what it meant.
Because you didn't know what it meant.
Yeah.
It's country style, so we actually have the traditional tea music, but done with a fiddle and strings. Mm-hmm. Fiddle and strings. Fiddles have strings. And we have 5 jokes with chickens, cows,
roosters,
and various other livestock, and a lot of southern accents thrown onto these Muppets who normally don't talk that way.
Mm-hmm. I think I liked one of these.
Which was?
The first Chicken and Rooster, which I believe was...
The Black Rooster is played by Hanson.
Yep.
And I know Louise Gold plays a chicken, but I don't know if she plays this chicken.
The chicken says, oh, why don't y'all run away with me? And the rooster says, I can't. I gotta think of my wife and eggs. I thought that was clever.
I thought that while they were casting about for farm animals, the strangeness of the goat dancing and his dance partner says, why is that rooster winking at your wife? The goat replies, he's trying to get my goat. And of course, if a goat is married to a goat, then that's his goat because women have no rights. And and so that was a weird piece of wordplay, except why is this goat dancing with another person?
Well, it does, going back to the first joke that we didn't talk about.
I hate barn dances. Only reason I come is for the door prize.
Well, what's the prize?
A free ticket to the next barn dance.
I have a feeling that these type of barn dances were things that you did just go and dance with anyone. Mm. Not necessarily only your partner. You'd be like, oh, yeah, this is a group thing. We're just all going to mix and mingle and dance.
Well, if it were a square dance or a contra dance, yes. Mm-hmm. That is definitely a thing where you swing your partner round and round, do-si-do, and circle to the left. And then you would end up with a different partner. But this is couples dancing as opposed to group dancing or line dancing.
But I think that's a limitation of Muppets being one person with two hands up doing both puppets.
Fair point. So, we've caught them somewhere down the dance away from their partner that they're going to rejoin up with so that they can bow to their partner, bow to their corner, and then applaud for the person who's calling the dance.
Correct. Yeah. Or, yeah, we came in right after the do-si-do and we leave before the next do-si-do.
The next backstage segment, because it's the second act, has Fozzie doing pure exposition and reintroducing the concept of the runner directly down the camera, where he says, oh boy, remember how the theater was on fire? Well, it still is. In some of the most cack-handed but entertaining badly done dialogue the Muppets have done so far.
Meanwhile, Link, Rolf, and the Swedish Chef are all in the background with a bucket brigade trying to put out the fire.
Link, Rolf, Swedish Chef, all vocally performed by?
Jim.
That's correct. And so when Kermit comes on to interact with Fozzie, we have three silent Muppets because somebody else is doing this. It's almost like they didn't have anybody else of their normal party of players to do this. They just had some of their helpers, and so they laid in an in-joke of course none of them can talk, because it's only Jim and Frank on screen at the moment.
I wonder also, though, how much of this is it. Season 3, we've never seen these Muppets on screen together, even though they're not talking. Mm. Let's have them interact with each other.
Even though they're facing away from the camera in the background with a bucket line.
Yeah, because then maybe there it because this is the age before the internet, people assume and know that Jim does these, but maybe he doesn't? Question mark?
Potentially. But as you say, it is interesting to have them interact because they normally can't.
Right.
Although this sketch does end with once Kermit leaves, Fozzie then goes to interact with the line, and he specifically is interacting with Link, saying,
give me the bucket! No, I want a full bucket, you fool! Will you get away from me? Will you stop crying?
And Jim is doing the voice.
But Kermit also interacts with Swedish Chef.
Chef, come here. Explain to the frog all the things here. Explain.
Yeah, so we have Henson switching between the voices, but somebody else has to be puppeteering those puppets.
Yeah, because just running through it, Kermit wants to know what's going on with the smoke still. Fozzie asks him if he didn't get a cigar, gives him a cigar. Kermit spits it out, demands an explanation for what's going on.
Before that, though, once he's got the cigar, Fozzie asks him,
have you any idea what it feels like to be a father?
And Kermit says, I've never seen Yellowstone.
Yeah, this won't be written for another 45 years.
And then, yeah, so there's all this traditional sitcom malarkey of Fozzie lying in order to cover up the smoke and the fire because he's afraid he's going to get fired.
Mm-hmm.
But there never feels like there's any stakes.
I mean, Fozzie could get fired. Of course there's steaks.
There's...
And those steaks, cooking medium rare right now, because it's a low, slow heat.
Yes, of course, that's the impetus. That's why Fozzie should be freaking out, but the energy is never real. Mm-hmm. Fozzie introducing this by saying, remember when the theater is on fire, does not... It's not the same as, remember when I was worried I was going to get fired if anything goes wrong. That's what should be the tension in these segments, and it never is.
Yeah, this episode would have been better, even though we hate J.P. Gross, if the tension was trying to prevent J.P. Gross from finding out that his building is actively on fire.
And while the episode will end with a callback to the fire in the Statler and Waldorf segment and in the farewells, the smoke starts happening right before the Swedish Chef segment. As you said, why would we cut to the Swedish Chef? If he hadn't been baking, if there had been a fire on the stove, they could have actually done real runner throughout with like things catching on fire. And they didn't do that. Nope. It's the complete opposite of the adage. There is smoke, there is no fire.
Despite Fozzie screaming it many, many times.
In a crowded theater.
Yep.
Although, most of the time, that crowded theater is just populated by silent gyms.
And the same three rows of Muppets after each other.
In different outfits.
Yeah. At one point, Fozzie tries to get Swedish Chef to explain to Kermit. Kermit gets frustrated by this. We alluded to this earlier. And he runs off stage, which ends up being on stage because he intros Gonzo in the next segment.
Mm-hmm. He's talking to the audience during this introduction, but he then does an aside in the middle of it. So he starts off by saying, in his premiere presentation of Immortal Perfection, and then he says, otherwise known as Rank Stupidity, and I think that aside is being delivered to camera.
Okay.
This is one of the best examples of the difference between audience and audience that's done, as it's very clear that the first is being done to the theater, but his aside is being delivered to the audience at home.
I agree.
Anyhow, ladies and gentlemen, in his premiere presentation of Immortal Perfection, otherwise known as Rank Stupidity.
Then he intros the act itself by saying the great Gonzo yodel Rimsky-Korsakov while riding on a motorized pogo stick.
Oh, we've referred to Rimsky-Korsakov before in this podcast, but...
Sure.
I'll leave it alone. And Gonzo does a great job of yelling, hi-yidi, 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 hi. It is not recognizable as Rimsky-Korsakov in any way, shape, or form, but it still is hilariously entertaining.
I'm sure the music bed is probably... No.
But yeah, but it's almost indiscernible.
Yo, yo, lady, ho!
The motorized pogo stick turns into the sound effect of an outboard motor and then that of a jackhammer, and he burrows through the floor.
Falling through a newly crafted hole in the stage for our first official fall of the episode.
And is this two episodes in a row where there's been a hole in the stage? Or is the previous episode just slipping?
Yes, it's just slipping. It was the season finale
that
had the hole in the stage, I believe, of season two.
We then have an audience shot.
Everyone loved that bit because they're all laughing.
Or are they just laughing in traditional schadenfreude of Gonzo having gotten hurt?
Hey, either way, they're loving this, baby. That's all Gonzo cares about.
But it also allows them to do a reset of the stage because Kermit is able to come out. And again, I talk about this feels like Frank and Jim by themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We have what you would refer to as Frank and Jim business.
Mm-hmm.
Kermit calls for Scooter to shut off the lights. The lights go off, but we don't hear anything from Richard Hunt.
Yep.
Because the lights are off, Kermit falls through the hole in the stage.
Fall
he says
two.
He lands on Gonzo, but we don't hear anything from Dave.
Where are you? I'm over here by the hole.
I'll follow the sound of your...
Oh, oh, no! Oh, Kermit, are you hurt?
Not too bad. I landed on Gonzo.
We have two references to Muppets who should be involved in this action, but they're not. It's just Frank and Jim doing bits and making it seem, I say unsuccessfully by my tone of voice, as if... They are involved, but it feels more to me like they threw something together without the other puppeteers around able to help.
Yeah, could be. Who knows? Not us.
But But because Fozzie is still on stage, he does at the introduction of Mr. Roy Clark.
Then calls for the curtains, realizes that that is also him, and he rushes off stage to go open the curtains for Roy's final act.
The final act by Roy Clark is Sally Was a Good Old Girl, which was performed by Hank Cochran in 1962, Roy Clark in 1963, Fats Domino in 1964, Waylon Jennings in 1964. I found this song to be a wee bit creepy in that if you listen to the lyrics, it has that vibe of, well, my first thought was Mustang Sally, which is an innuendo-laden bit about a woman who gets around town. But Mustang Sally was written in 1965. However, it's also redolent of Minnie the Moocher from 1931, which is about a woman who, because she's trying to be upwardly mobile, is willing to go with anybody who will take care of her in order to get stuff. But the subtext of Sally Was a Good Old Girl is there's this young girl that the singer has grown up with who he can fool around with and is probably trading sexual favors with everybody in town.
And if you wanted a kiss or a little bitty squeeze, she was always willing and do her best to please. A girl made to love and not made to tease. Sally was a good old girl.
And it's gross.
See, Ben, as someone who's often bored by musical numbers, I did not pay attention to this at all up until the singing chickens.
So you didn't even pay attention to when there's a chicken and a fox in a cage and the fox bites the neck of the chicken in order to kill it and then the chicken magically comes back to life?
I didn't understand what was happening there. I noticed something happening. I went, what was that?
That was a fox doing the traditional fox thing of grabbing a chicken by the neck and shaking it until its neck broke. And then that zombie chicken kept singing.
Well, the fox clearly didn't jump from the northeast direction where they're successful 98% of the time. Thank you, QI.
Yeah, there's business with farm animals and with instrumentalists, but not very much. In fact, the band is largely in the background, not doing much interaction with Roy, who's pretty much just strutting around by himself with the Muppets, largely unattached. And if it wasn't for that bit where he conducts the chickens, and when the cow and he have a little duet over the barn door, it might as well be the earlier Roy segment where there are Muppets on stage, but Roy basically doesn't have anything to do with it. We get a little Roy Muppet interaction here, and those Muppets are funny, but it's kind of an afterthought. And the one shot of the chicken murder by the fox is not unlike in the previous episode where you have a bit of Beauregard sweeping in the desert. But that's a joke that doesn't belong in the rest of the number.
Mm-hmm.
This fox murder also doesn't belong in the rest of this number.
Mm.
But they also needed something because their guest star was not interacting with the puppets.
But what the guest star did interact with is a gas mask that was conveniently placed on stage when smoke from the fire finally makes its way towards the stage.
Because when you're in a barn with a bunch of livestock, you obviously keep a gas mask on a barrel.
Uh-huh.
Just obviously. In case you get some hay dander up your nose.
It's hay fever season. Gotta keep your body tight.
So you just have a gas mask ready to rock.
It is prime Cold War season, so, you know, it's actually not that unreasonable for people to have gas masks in their barns.
All I know is if somebody walked into a barn and came out with a gas mask, it would be like the Invaders from Outer Space scene in the future site of the Twin Pine Mall in Back to the Future.
After that gas mask, we go to our outro where Kermit is bandaged up from his fall. Fozzie enters begging not to be fired still. Kermit says he's not going to. And Fozzie is surprised by this and runs down the list of everything that went wrong this episode. The stagehands, the hole, the fire, and just like earlier, but the reverse, when he says the fire, Kermit never knew there was a fire.
Yeah, his whole smoke job about trying to keep Kermit in the dark about there was a fire had been successful, wildly enough.
It went so badly, not even Fozzie thought it worked. And Fozzie is delusional.
But Kermit's also been bonked on the head by falling through the floor and landing on Gonzo. So maybe he'd forgotten about the fire. But in this case, he is aghast that there's a fire. Fozzie denies it and then backs up on it immediately, saying,
"We had a fire here?"
No. well, at least yes. Oh, a cute little small one.
Yep. You love it when somebody says one thing and then immediately recants.
Yep.
Did this work for you?
Absolutely. And then follows that up by saying, "Kermit, you wouldn't hit a bear in front of a guest star, would you?" And calls for Roy Clark to come on stage just to make sure.
Just to protect himself.
You know, hitting the bear in front of the hundreds of Muppets in the audience and viewers on screen?
Totally normal.
But a guest star.
So he says, "Roy, you're a real hot fiddle player." And Roy says, "No, it's just a hot fiddle." And shakes the fiddle that he's holding in order for the chemicals to mix inside it. And smoke starts billowing out through the sound holes. Pretty good trick in the special effect.
And this is what I was alluding to earlier when you were saying he doesn't know how to play the fiddle. I think this wasn't a real fiddle because it had those chemicals in there.
But he comes out sawing away at it and sort of making noise, although the strings are very loosely strung. But he's playing it with the same kind of verve that he did in the box, which makes me think he's either knows how to play or he knows how to be good at faking it. But I assumed the latter.
Where I assumed the former, because of all the awards he's won for instrumentalist... Because of all the awards he's won for instrumentation.
Do you want to try that again?
I don't remember the sentence anymore. So either cut it all out or leave it all in.
Keep it all in and triple it. They yell fire, fire again in a crowded theater, and then all the firemen, who, as you say, wouldn't have been known to the U.S. audience, rush on stage and fall in the hole.
Four of them. We're up to six falls now. Would have been 18, but it's only six.
And they go to credits, where finally we get to see the female trumpeter play her music.
It's all Ben's been waiting for this whole episode.
And at the end, as I referred to earlier, Statler and Waldorf bring up the idea about the fire, where Statler says, "I thought for once the show really caught fire."
Waldorf, however, thought it burnt itself out, same as always.
Meh.
Yeah, agreed. Cut to Zoot. Not a great ending punchline.
Who directed this episode, Pete?
Peter Harris.
Interesting. I would have guessed, based on the staging of what you thought was boring but I thought was elegantly done photographically, the Roy Clark number with the orchestra pit, and based on the split screen, that this might have been a Philip K. Sohn episode.
See, I did like that initial shot. It was everything that happened after that setup shot of the stage and the pit in Yesterday When I Was Young that I did not care about. Mm. But I did like that. I thought that was creative, the first shot.
So well done. Our veteran three-season director is coming up with new ideas for staging of the musical numbers. And so nice to see that early on in this season, he's playing some games.
Yeah. Ben?
Yes.
Do you know how many camera takes you had total?
According to my records, and I didn't talk about all of them during this episode, I counted 13 camera takes.
Wow.
In the previous episode, I also counted 13 takes.
Wow.
With an additional 9 that were probably just at the camera.
It was to the camera.
Uh-huh. For example, in the Muppet Studio performance of Blue by Helen Reddy, she sings the second chorus and the finale looking right at the camera.
Yeah, I agree with the earlier statement that those don't count. We are counting office takes.
Yep. And so 13 per episode so far.
Interesting. And thank you for doing that for the first episode, because I was never gonna. Well, since you started talking about stats because I asked you, here's the rest of the statistics for the episode.
Mm-hmm.
There was 10.06 minutes of music out of 26.5 minutes of episode for 37.96%, which is about 66% of what we had last week. We had 16 hits, still no explosions this season. Hmm. I had 18 written down, but it was 6 falls. No human Muppet kisses. There was one Muppet kiss, but I'm not counting those. 13 camera takes, and nothing else of things that I've been counting over previous seasons.
Well, we've got two brand new statistics that we're adding on to things. Because some of the more catchphrasey stuff has gone away, it's nice to have new things to look at and check.
And as for Roy's ranking,
yeah,
I went back and forth on this. He's obviously going to be in the towards the bottom, but while I agree that his Muppet stuff was bad, I really liked Rocky Top and thought the interactions he was having with himself were very good. He clearly likes himself. He thinks he's very funny.
Yes, he does.
So do I. Not him. Meaning, I think I'm very funny. I don't think he's very funny, but I relate to him in that sense.
Game recognizes yes. Game.
Yes.
Because, as a Yellowstone-watching dad, nothing's funnier than a dad joke, and that the dad joke is predicated on the idea of nobody likes this joke but me.
Yeah. It's the best feeling in the world. It's almost better than laughter. When you say a joke, groans are great.
And Roy Clark's dad joke energy is strong, especially in the talk spot, but also the way in which he's trying to make eye contact with himself in a self-congratulatory way in that first segment.
Again, nothing he said was funny this whole episode. I want to reiterate, I don't think he's funny, but I know he thinks he's funny, and I know I'm funny, which I hope the first part that I said about him isn't true about me. Anyway, 19.
Sorry, that's just some built-up laughter about Roy Clark coming to the surface.
I know nothing I said is funny, even though I'm hilarious.
Well, now that we've got that out of the way, and we have a potential difficult low bar to clear, a difficult limbo to manage in future guests, let's talk about some of our five favorite moments of this episode so we can go out talking about something that we enjoyed potentially more than Roy Clark's performance, but not more than Roy Clark enjoyed himself.
Absolutely.
I'm going to start off this week with the way in which they did the substitution of the Gonzo puppet in the Rimsky-Korsakov jackhammer routine.
Oh.
So when it starts off and he's doing the hidey-hidey-ho bit going up and down on the pogo stick, it's Dave controlling the puppet because you can never see Gonzo's legs. And as the pogo stick starts going up and down, he goes off camera and then it comes back on almost instantaneously with Gonzo being a full-bodied Muppet with his legs dangling off the bottom of the pogo stick.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very fast. Now, that could be done to edit, or it could be excellent, quick substitution. But Goals' voice pattern never stops. And whether that was done during live or whether it was done post, it helps paper over the transition very well. But also, the puppet of Gonzo that's now bouncing up and down on the pogo stick is hilarious. So everything about that sketch was very technically well executed. And you really almost don't notice it if you're not doing what we do and trying to break down the technical aspects of it. It helps sell the illusion of Gonzo being real. It gets some Muppet legs up on screen. Mm-hmm. And if it was done slowly with a substitution and vocal editing, or if it was done live, either one of those is a technical achievement worthy of being proud of.
For my first moment, our second moment, I am going to do something a little out of the ordinary and talk about something that Frank Oz did. This is a very Fozzie-heavy episode, and all five moments from this episode could easily be Frank Fozzie moments.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to talk about one of the first moments of the show, which is one of my favorite versions of Fozzie, which is subdued Fozzie. Fozzie and Kermit in the intro of the show get in, as I said earlier, and you said that I said earlier, a classic Frank and Jim argument. And Fozzie, during the argument, gets quiet and just goes, "Well, you don't have to shout. I'm just a bear."
Yeah, Fozzie's identity as a bear comes up a couple of times in a weird way this episode. I don't know why Frank was in the headspace of Fozzie's bearness would have been something that made him feel vulnerable.
Well, this just dawned on me.
Yeah.
When was Smokey the Bear introduced? Let me give that a quick goog.
Never say that again.
Apparently based on a real bear found in 1950? No, first appearance 1944.
Which, based on the Ronald Duck and Sopwith Camel jokes, you feel like, makes me feel like they should have done a blatant, obvious two-camera Smokey the Bear joke in this episode, but apparently they didn't make the connection. Only you did 45 years later.
Only I can identify Smokey the Bear homages. Nice. Thank you. See, I am funny.
I'm tempted to try and do, since you were talking about the idea that you could do all five moments as Frank moments, to try and do all three of my moments as Gonzo moments, but I don't think I'm going to, although...
Gonzo does appear three times in this episode, so you could.
His first appearance is really, really good.
His second one is really, really good.
But I don't think I'm going to. I instead think I'm going to steal an obvious moment, which is, for my second moment, our third moment, the middle moment, I want to talk about something that I hovered over earlier, which was the sprinkling of the flour in the Swedish Chef segment. Obviously, the physical action of the shaking of the flour and the explosion of the flour is very funny, but actually, the thing that primed me for it was the fake Swedish of it all. The fake Swedish, as far as I can tell, is sprickly de fleur on de dew. And the dew and the fleur, it's such an obvious bad substitution. And yet, at the same time, it was mumbled just enough that it actually took me concentrating to figure out that those weren't nonsense syllables. It wasn't like de boomber shoot. Because flour and dough are one-syllable words, it felt like it was just normal glossolalia, and it wasn't until I concentrated on it that I realized he's doing the same thing he always does in terms of the mock Swedish substitutions. I'd also like to point out that in the subtitles, while it does say speaking mock Swedish during the theme song, it says indistinct singing, which is not true. It is distinct. It is distinctive. It is also mock Swedish.
Yep.
And the idea that the subtitle people are like, no, it's just mumbling. We just can't tell what he's saying. It was, for me, indistinct mock Swedish, and the fact that I took some time to discover that he was doing individual vocal play of those words made it more fun for me.
And, as I said earlier, you're the world's biggest LeBron James fan, and you love the phrase, we are all witnesses, which he shouts before every game, throwing flour into the air.
The only real witness that I'm a fan of is when Danny Glover dies in a grain silo because of Harrison Ford in Witness. If he'd only had a gas mask, he could have survived.
He could have. He could have indeed. For my second moment, our fourth moment, my final moment, I'm going to talk about something that we don't often talk about.
What's that?
Scooter. We did talk about it already. That moment with him on the balcony silent, ducking down and looking around when there's jet planes flying overhead.
With the world's worst mechanical sound impression that Fozzie's doing basically right in Kermit's ear and yet apparently worked.
The way he looks around, and then when it's clear and he pops his head up and he looks to make sure it's safe, it's so good. Even if that wasn't Richard.
Well, that's what's particularly fascinating about this is who knows who that was, but they did a great job.
Yep. All we do know is it wasn't Frank and it wasn't Jim, so therefore, counts. So despite how much I wanted to talk about Fozzie saying to the firemen, are you proud of yourselves? You made this chicken a nervous wreck. I'm going to talk about Scooter.
Good for you. For my third moment, our fifth moment, my fifth moment so far in the series, our tenth moment, I'm going to talk about something we mentioned briefly earlier, but it really made me happy, which was the in-camera effect of the three heads of Statler on screen. When that's normally done, it's with a camera lens that's a prism. It's what we saw during the Kermit Happy Feet segment, where you can then have, in real time, in camera, multiple images of what's happening in front of you. But how they did it so that they did that real-time in-camera moment in little bubbles as if they were able to superimpose the live feed prism effect in an existing camera shot? Like, I'm literally not sure quite how they did that, but it was really impressive because they're also at slightly different angles.
That's
you look
what I was
at
going
the
to say.
Heads.
To wildly speculate.
Mm, please.
Is that they had three cameras next to each other in the way you would have the 3D-esque of the tilted the 2.5 degrees or whatever.
Yeah.
But they just did three cameras at that angle and then did the green screen or so. How they edited it in,
yeah.
No idea. But yes, I also noticed they're all at slightly different angles.
And so it's kind of the equivalent of the classic Sears Studio music video effect of... Mm. The person's being filmed from two angles, but they're being composited on the screen. But we've got three cameras compositing Statler's head in a little circle on the same screen right there.
I wonder how they do that.
Do what?
Again, technically, it's so well done. Jim has always been fascinated with camera effects, digital effects, and optical effects. He loves playing with film and video and has been a great innovator in that regard. And for such a silly throwaway gag, I'm sure that took a lot of technical wrangling. But it's also creepy and fun in equal measure. I really appreciated it pretty much on every level. And the fact that it just happens and unhappens in such a quick succession. And I can't think of another example of them doing anything like that in the show. I'm now going to be, like, primed for, now that they were able to accomplish that, did they use it for anything else?
Mm.
Or was it literally just like, that's all, we just wanted that one gag, and that's all we needed to do. So much fun.
And also, we've been critical of their ability to green screen before.
Mm-hmm.
And it is obvious this is an effect.
Yeah.
But it's not, it's so much better than
yeah.
previous effects. Where
the
you're like, oh,
super
I can
tight
tell.
Circles on the heads and the different angles. And the fact that they're happening simultaneously
mm-hmm.
helps make it real in an interesting way.
Which is one of the reasons why I think it was all shot with those three cameras
uh-huh.
at once. So that way it
yep.
matches perfectly.
Right. Yeah, they didn't do it afterwards and then pump them in.
Mm-hmm.
That was in camera somehow.
Yeah, very good. Very well done. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Sam and Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Blue Sky at Farst Name Basis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in the podcast are used for the purposes of review. If there are things, dates, facts, names, chicken murder, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
Meow.
And we'll see you next time when we discuss Season 3, Production Episode 6, guest starring Gene Stapleton. Yay!